Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, July 10th, 2025. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes just three names: Sharon Holly Lichter, 83, of Phoenix; Cynthia Pendleton Rubicam, 94, of Phoenix; and Laura Leigh Simon Woodruff, 59, of Buckeye. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the people listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the business section of the paper. Our first article is entitled, EIA Says U.S. Power to Reach Record Highs. This was written by Scott DeSavino for the Reuters News Group. U.S. power consumption will hit record highs in 2025 and 2026, according to the Energy Information Administration in its short-term energy outlook published on July 8th. The EIA projected power demand will rise to 4.189 trillion kilowatt hours in 2025, and then in 2026 it'll go up to 4.278 trillion kilowatt hours, because in 2024 we were just at 4.097 trillion kilowatt hours. Those demand increases come in part from data centers dedicated to artificial intelligence and cryptocurrency, and as homes and businesses use more electricity and less fossil fuels. The EIA forecast 2025 power sales will rise to 1.517 trillion kilowatt hours for residential consumers, 1.474 trillion kilowatt hours for commercial customers, and 1.052 trillion kilowatt hours for industrial customers. Those forecasts compare to all-time highs of 1.509 trillion kilowatt hours for residential consumers back in 2022, and in 2024, commercial customers got their all-time high of 1.434 trillion kilowatt hours, and back in 2000, industrial customers had a rate of 1.064 trillion kilowatt hours. Now, the EIA said that natural gas's share of power generation would slide from 42% in 2024 to 40% in 2025 and 2026. Coal's share will rise from 16% in 2024 to 17% in 2025 before sliding to 15% in 2026 as renewable output rises. The percentage of renewable generation will rise from 23% in 2024 to 25% in 2025 and 26% in 2026, while nuclear power's share will diminish from 19% in 2024 to 18% in 2025 and 2026, according to their outlook. Now, the EIA projected that gas sales in 2015 would rise to 13.1 billion cubic feet per day for residential consumers. This compares with all-time highs of 14.3 billion cubic feet per day in 1996. And that was the article, EIA Says U.S. Power to reach Record Heights. Our second article is about a little more local news. Phoenix Children's Hospital names a new CEO. This is by Stephanie Innes for the Arizona Republic. Officials with Phoenix Children's Hospital on July 8th announced that they had hired a new president and CEO to replace the longtime leader, Robert Meyer, who was retiring. John R. Nickens IV, who was hired after a national search, will come to Arizona from Louisiana, where he serves as corporate president of hospitals and CEO of University Medical Center for LCMC Health, which is a large regional health system based in New Orleans. In Louisiana, Nickens built a statewide network of pediatric care and in 2020 launched one of the country's largest freestanding pediatric behavioral health hospitals. Now, Meyer, who led Phoenix Children's Hospital for 23 years, has said the increased need for behavioral health care among Phoenix Children's patients is a huge issue. So Nickens will assume leadership by October 1st, officials said. In a prepared statement, Nickens said that he is eager to broaden the pediatric health system's academic partnerships, quote, as we collaborate to train the next generation of clinicians that our country needs, unquote. Nickens and Meyer will work closely together throughout a September transition period to ensure continuity and a smooth handoff. To many Phoenix residents, Phoenix Children's Hospital is known by its main hospital, which is an 11-story tower visible from State Route 51 and noticeable for its white heart in a hand logo and red lights that glow at night. But Phoenix Children's is a health system for kids rather than just one hospital. It has 50 locations in the valley, which includes two ambulatory surgery centers, as well as pediatric hospitals in the East Valley and Avondale and Glendale. The system includes more than 1,400 pediatric primary care providers and a total of about 8,000 employees. The hospital system began in 1983 with 32 providers working out of leased space inside what was then known as Good Samaritan Hospital, or Good Sam. Well, Good Sam is now Banner University Medical Center in Phoenix. Phoenix Children's spent its first 20 years inside Good Sam and moved to its main campus on Thomas Road in 2003. And that's when the organization, with Meyer at the helm, began building its specialty programs, which now include heart, liver, and kidney transplants, and a joint bone marrow transplant program with the Mayo Clinic. And that's the article, Phoenix Children's Hospital Names a New CEO. Our third article from the business section was titled, Boycott Organizers Blast Targets Church Donation. This was written by Betty Lynn Fisher for the USA Today. Target has donated $300,000 to the National Baptist Convention, and two separate leaders of the boycotts against the retailer are calling for the church organization to return the gift. So in separate comments, Nakima Levi Armstrong, who is a Minnesota activist who launched a Target boycott on February 1st, and the Reverend Jamal Harrison Bryant, who encouraged members of the Black faith community to support for 40 days, and now permanently stay away from the retailer, have said the acceptance by the Black church organization works against their efforts. Now, both boycotts are in response to what Levi Armstrong and Bryant said were efforts by Target to turn its back on the Black community when it rolled back its diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. A Target spokesman provided USA Today with a statement when asked about the donation. That statement said, quote, we're proud to be sponsoring NBC USA's conference series as one of the many ways we invest to make a meaningful impact in communities across the country by supporting access to education, economic development initiatives, and entrepreneurship programs, unquote. Well, the National Baptist Convention did not return an email and phone inquiry from USA Today seeking comment on the donation and the calls for its return. However, in a news release provided to other media outlets, the National Baptist Convention president, Boise Kimber, said the partnership is based on, quote, a shared commitment to community empowerment through small businesses and entrepreneur development, as well as investments in education and student support, and workforce and skill development that unlocks growth across our communities. Kimber said the donation will help the church organization provide scholarships, support senior citizens, and invest in entrepreneurship programs that uplift our people and the future, unquote. Well, during a June 22nd sermon at his New Birth Missionary Baptist Church, located in Stonecrest, Georgia, Bryant decried Target's donation to the National Baptist Convention. He accused Target, whose CEO had met with Bryant and the Reverend Al Sharpton back in April, of going around him to the National Baptist Convention. He said, quote, "Are you crazy to think we're going to sell out for chump change?" unquote. In an interview with USA Today, Bryant said that Target's donation to the National Baptist Convention, which Bryant said is not affiliated with his church, was actually four donations of $75,000 to black church organizations that the National Baptist Convention received and split. Bryant said of the donation and the National Baptist Convention accepting the money, quote, "It's really a slap in the face and an insult," unquote. Bryant has called for the money to be returned to Target. As part of his Target boycott, Bryant has made four demands, including honoring a $2 billion pledge to the black business community that Target previously had in place, which entailed purchasing black-owned products, services, and investing in black media. Bryant also called for the retailer to invest in black-owned banks, establish retail centers at historically black colleges and universities, and fully restore their DEI initiatives. Bryant said, quote, "The black eye for us is that they, the National Baptist Convention, walked away with nothing that we asked for," unquote. Now, Target previously released a statement back on May 28th in response to Bryant's Target boycott and demands. Their statement was, quote, "Target is absolutely dedicated to fostering inclusivity for everyone, our team members, our guests, and our supply partners. In the last 5 years, we have committed to invest $2 billion in black-owned businesses and brands within 5 years, supported students at over 20 historically black colleges and universities, invested $100 million to black-led community organizations, given scholarships to over 30,000 members of our team to advance their careers, committed 5% of our profits to the communities that we operate in, and volunteered millions of hours to organizations across the country, and created meaningful opportunities for our team members to thrive both personally and professionally," unquote. In a separate open letter sent to the National Baptist Convention and shared with USA Today, Levi Armstrong, founder of the Racial Justice Network, urged the church group, quote, "to reconsider its alignment with a corporation that has caused such profound harm. This $300,000 payment does not heal. It deepens the wound. It appears to be a payout for silence and an attempt to regain black consumer trust without accountability," unquote, the letter said. The letter was signed by fellow organizers Monique Coolers-Dotti, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Minnesota, and Jelani Hussein, executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Minnesota. The letter also took issue with Bryant, saying he was aware of the Target boycott, which started on February 1st, and he expressed interest in joining the effort. But then Bryant repackaged the work as his own, creating a separate campaign and erasing the women's work. The women said it was reflective of a long, painful history. Bryant told USA Today that he has honored Levi Armstrong and said from the start that he did not start this Target boycott. He said, quote, "We were not the originators of it. but it was our intention to bring out the black church alongside, unquote. And that was the article, Boycott Organizers Blast Target's Church Donation. Well, we just passed 15 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the sports section now. So on the front page of the sports section, at the top of the page, there's a picture of three WNBA basketball players, and two of them are Phoenix Suns, and the other one in the middle is the Lynx forward Nafisa Collier. And it says, the Mercury's Dawana Bonner on the right is grabbed by Lynx forward Nafisa Collier as Alyssa Thomas sets a screen. And this was on July 9th at PHX Arena. And that's when the Mercury won 79-71. Underneath the picture is the title, Taking Control. This was an article written by Jenna Ortiz for the Arizona Republic. The Phoenix Mercury made a statement, going on a 19-4 run to end the game and toppling the WNBA-leading Minnesota Lynx in a 79-71 win on July 9th at PHX Arena. The Mercury's defense, and incidentally, the Mercury's record is 14-6, their defense made the Lynx look unusually frantic in the later stages of the game. With a four-point lead, the Mercury's pressure caused Alana Smith to overthrow a pass to Kayla McBride on the wing, sending the ball into the Mercury bench with a minute and 2 seconds left. Even with the stars Satu Sabali and Kalia Copper out, the Mercury matched up well against the Lynx, and the Lynx record is 17-3, with Alyssa Thomas facilitating and taking the game over during the dry spells. The Mercury had a back-and-forth affair from the second quarter until the latter parts of the fourth quarter. Thomas, who had a triple-double in the previous game, led all scorers with a career-high 29 points, 8 rebounds, and 5 assists. Head coach Nate Tibbetts said, quote, it was a heck of a performance by her. She's had back-to-back big-time games. She did it attacking downhill. She found it on her rolls. This is a team where we're still figuring out who we are and how teams are going to play us, unquote. Rookie point guard Monique Okoa-Makani posted 13 points, including 8 in the second half. The Mercury turned to 16-year veteran forward Dawana Bonner off the bench following her signing on July 8th. In her first game in nearly a month, Bonner contributed 7 points and 6 rebounds in over 26 minutes. Tibbetts said, quote, we're extremely excited for DB to be here, and she's someone we've tried to go after the last two off seasons. We really love her versatility, her playoff experience, her shot making, so we're excited to get her back in a Mercury uniform, unquote. So with that 6'4" forward on the floor, the Mercury had spacing and allowed Thomas to take over in a game where mid-range and paint touches mattered. The Lynx significantly cut down on the Mercury's three-point game, forcing them to go 1 of 16. But the Mercury and Thomas found their spots in the paint, outscoring the Lynx 56-34. So the Lynx finished with one more rebound than the Mercury, but it was a slow start on the boards for Phoenix, especially with Minnesota's Jessica Shepherd grabbing 7 rebounds in over 7 minutes off the bench in the first half. Tibbetts said the Lynx kicked our butt on the boards in the first half, causing the coaching staff to challenge the players to limit those second touches. Tibbetts said, quote, to hold the team to 34 points in the second half is a credit. You're doing a lot of good things. I think we had 2 or 3 shot clock violations, maybe could have had a fourth, but Courtney Williams hit a tough shot. We were extremely gritty and showed a ton of toughness on that defensive end, unquote. Now, Shepherd played only 3 minutes in the second half and didn't get a rebound. MVP candidate Nafisa Collier was held to 4 points on 3 shots in the first half, but became a problem for the Mercury early in the second half with 6 points in the first 5 minutes. Collier did what she does best in the second half, challenging teams in the paint and grabbing second-chance points. 7 of her 8 field goals were in the paint. She finished the game with 18 points on 8 of 15 shooting and 7 rebounds, while Courtney Williams led with 21 points. And that was Taking Control. Our next article from the front page of the sports section, D-backs robbed of 2 home runs in shutout. Padres 1, D-backs 0. This was by Jason M. Romero for the Arizona Republic out of San Diego. Whatever calf problem Merrill Kelly was dealing with in the 7th inning here against the Padres on Tuesday, July 8th, it was not a factor in the one pitch the Diamondbacks right-hander wished he could have back. Luis Arraez hit that 2-0 fastball into the seats in right field at Petco Park for the only run of the game in a 1-0 Padres win over Arizona. Kelly said, quote, "I have to tip my hat to Arraez on that pitch. That was probably the biggest miss I had all night. I just happened to yank it right where he could hit it out," unquote. Kelly, who is 7-5, was cruising until then. Even after the home run, he finished the inning and held the Padres to one run on 4 hits with 4 strikeouts in one of his best starts of the season. And before the right calf discomfort that he felt in the 7th inning, he hit 96 miles an hour on the radar gun, and he said he felt as good on the mound as he had all season. Now, the calf pain was minor, but given Kelly's history with cramping, he alerted manager Torey Lovullo, who did not send Kelly back out for the 8th inning. Kelly said he could have continued, and there was nothing to worry about. He said, quote, "It's just as tough losing any game. I don't think it matters how many runs we scored, how many runs they score. At the end of the day, the scoreboard says they had more than us. It all hits the same," unquote. But the run support was missing, in large part because the Diamondbacks were robbed of 2 home runs by Padres center fielder Jackson Merrill and right fielder Fernando Tatis Jr., who leaped up to catch high drives that looked headed for the seats. Corbin Carroll had a 2-run home run in the 5th inning, stolen by Merrill's catch, and Josh Naylor just missed the game-tying blast that Tatis stole in the 8th inning. Neither Carroll, Kelly, nor Lovullo had ever been a part of a game in which 2 home runs were snatched out of the air for outs, as far as they could recall. Carroll said, quote, "I thought it had a chance, but it happens. It's baseball. Just a shame to kind of waste that outing by Merrill. 2 really good plays to get back there and find those balls," unquote. Well, neither team committed an error. Lovullo said, quote, "It just goes to show you good defense can help you win games. And if you add it all up, it was the difference in the game," unquote. The Diamondbacks, whose record is presently 45-47, managed only 3 hits all night. They loaded the bases twice. They left 9 runners on base for the game, unable to score for the second time in 3 games. 5 Padres pitchers silenced the Diamondbacks, including All-Star Jason Adam and Robert Suarez, who was added to the NL roster as an injury replacement. Lovullo said, quote, "They have one of the best bullpens in baseball, so we know what's potentially coming out of that bullpen. I felt like it had a chance of playing out the way it did, so it was frustrating. I believe in our team offensively, and we can score runs. We built innings. We just couldn't get that big hit," unquote. Now, Ketel Marte returned to the Diamondbacks lineup for Tuesday against the Padres after missing the previous game with right groin tightness. Marte batted second, playing second base. Diamondbacks manager Torey Lovullo said before the game, quote, "I think he's in a good spot," unquote. But the Diamondbacks, for the second straight night, had a late scratch from the lineup. Alek Thomas was originally set to play center field and bat 8th. But he was removed, and he's now day-to-day with right knee soreness. Thomas did pinch hit in the bottom of the 9th, but he struck out to end the game. The new lineup had Randall Grichuk as the designated hitter batting eighth. Jake McCarthy, who was originally the designated hitter for July 8th, was moved to center field and bats seventh. Now, in other injury news, closer Shelby Miller has returned to Phoenix and was undergoing imaging on his right forearm strain from July 8th. Reliever Ryan Thompson's test revealed a strained shoulder and neck area, and first baseman designated hitter Paven Smith's imaging confirmed a medical diagnosis of a strained right oblique. Lavulo said of Smith, quote, "He's feeling much better," unquote. Right-hander reliever Kendall Graveman, hip, is operating on a Tuesday and Friday game schedule in which he pitches in Arizona Complex League games. He was scheduled to throw in one such game on July 8th. Lavulo said, quote, "He feels really good, but we want that build-up to take place. We want him to get some innings, to log some time on the mound, and when he's ready and gets back here on the mound, that he doesn't have any more setbacks," unquote. Well, the fluidity was Lavulo's operative word when asked about he will decide who closes games for the Diamondbacks in Miller's absence. The team is missing three closers due to injury: Miller, A.J. Puk, and Justin Martinez. Lavulo said, quote, "We're going to just piece it together the best we can. We're going to make sure that everybody's available and they can go out there and throw on a given night. And then we'll just match up the best that I can," unquote. Kevin Ginkle was tapped to finish the game on July 7th and got the save. Jalen Beeks and Kyle Backus, a pair of left-handers, are also in the mix as closers. Ginkle said all he wants to do is help the team in whatever role he can, in hopes that the Diamondbacks are buyers at the trade deadline. Ginkle said, quote, "I know how good a pitcher I am, and that's what I'm falling back on. When you pitch in the ninth, their hitters are trying to put their A-plus swing together in their approach. It doesn't matter the score. To me, the guy that's pitching in the ninth, it's important to give your best stuff," unquote. Ginkle wasn't told at any point before or during the game on July 7th that he would be the closer that day, but he knew it would come down to him. He said, quote, "At the end of the day, I'm going to focus on whenever that phone rings," unquote. And that was the article, D-backs robbed of two home runs in shutout. The third article, from the front page of the sports section, ASU's chance at repeating among the storylines. This is by Michelle Gardner for the Arizona Republic, and it comes from Frisco, Texas. It's that time of year when every college football coach is optimistic. Nobody has lost a game yet, and everyone still has hopes of a conference championship. The Big 12 kicked off the season with two media days held at The Star in Frisco, Texas. The Star is headquarters of the NFL's Dallas Cowboys. Eight coaches and selected players talked about their teams on July 8th, with the other eight teams following suit on July 9th, the next day. The start of the regular season is 5 or so weeks away. So here are the storylines to follow as the Big 12 football season unfolds. Can Arizona repeat? The Sun Devils were the ultimate Cinderella story last season, emerging as conference champions despite picked to finish late in the preseason poll. Picked to finish last in the preseason poll, which led to the elimination of such polls. Battering Ram running back Cam Scadabo has moved to the NFL, but 16 starters and one specialist are returning. So much will be expected. The Sun Devils are not the gutty little underdog any longer. So how will they play when the pressure is on them? Repeating is not an easy task, particularly in a conference where there is parity. Oklahoma, which has since departed for the SEC, is the only team to repeat as outright conference champion, having done so on multiple occasions, most recently in 2019 and 2020. What will Colorado look like? Perhaps no team will look more different this season than Colorado. Heisman Trophy winner Travis Hunter is in the NFL. Quarterback Shedeur Sanders and his brother Shiloh have also gone. Colorado, who was 9-4 in 2024, returns only 3 starters on offense, but 8 on defense. Coach Deion Sanders' health issues have kept him home in Texas rather than in Colorado, where he was contractually obligated to conduct youth camps. Colorado also faces one of the toughest schedules in the conference, but last season it was one of the easiest. Next, who will be the quarterback at BYU? The Cougars looked to be a serious contender for a conference title after a strong showing last season. A big reason was senior quarterback Jake Retzlaff, who could make clutch plays to rally his team from tough positions. Off the field, adversity has come into play with a civil lawsuit filed against Retzlaff in May, alleging that he sexually assaulted a woman at his home. Retzlaff reportedly is no longer a part of the program. Coach Kalani Sitake hedged when asked if Retzlaff has indeed departed. Sitake said, quote, "First of all, I love Jake Retzlaff. We love Jake Retzlaff and appreciate all that he has done for our program. I think it'll be inappropriate for me to make a statement on his situation first. That's his right. I think it's a private matter that he can speak for himself, and I'm going to give him the opportunity to do that," unquote. Now, one candidate for the starting job is sophomore Treyson Bourget. He's brother of former ASU quarterback Trenton Bourget. McKay Hillstead, also a sophomore, will be in the mix, as will freshman Bear Bachmeyer. Our next story is, can Utah bounce back from a subpar season? Utah was a perennial title contender in its Pac-12 existence and was viewed as one of the favorites with its move to Big 12. Kyle Whittingham, the second longest tenured coach in FBS, heads into his 21st season. The Utes went 5-7 overall and 2-7 in Big 12 play. 6 of the school's 10-win seasons came with him at the helm, and he became Utah's winningest coach in 2022. The 2024 season marked just the 3rd time that a Whittingham-led team finished below 500, and the last previous time it had a losing record was 2013. So most of the issues come at quarterback. Utah will boast a newcomer there in junior Devin Dampier, a transfer from New Mexico. It has 10 returning starters on offense, led by linemen Spence Ofano and Caleb Lemieux, both preseason All-Big 12 selections. Next, what will Frost Rodriguez 2.0 look like? There are 2 coaching changes in the conference this season, though neither is new in the traditional sense. Scott Frost, 50 years old, is back at Central Florida, while Rich Rodriguez, who is 62, is starting a second tenure at West Virginia. Frost led the Knights to a 19-7 record in the 2016 and 2017 seasons. His brief stint was highlighted by a 13-0 record in 2017 that led the school to claim a mythical national championship. He rode the momentum of that season to Nebraska, where things didn't go quite as well. The Cornhuskers were just 16-31 in his 5 years there. He spent last season as an analyst for the NFL's Rams. "Going home isn't always easy," he said. Then he went on and said, "Going back isn't always easy. There was an easy choice for me because of how much we liked it there. UCF has grown so much and has so much growth potential. I've said this a lot today, but our 2017 run had a lot to do with UCF positioning itself in a place where it could become a candidate to be in a league by the Big 12. It's my goal to continue to try to help UCF push forward. If there's any more changes coming, We need to be positioned in the right place and to do everything we can to make it a legitimate competitor in this league and beyond. We have a lot of work to do to get there, but it's probably the only place that I would want to be doing this in college football." Unquote. Now, Rodriguez is a journeyman, having previously worked in Morgantown as head coach from 2001 to 2007. He was also there in lesser capacities in 1985 and 1989. Most recently, he was at Jacksonville State. Now, what new faces will emerge at running back with Arizona State? This was a position of strength in the Big 12 last year. Cam Scadabo of Arizona State, R.J. Harvey of Central Florida, Taj Brooks of Texas Tech, Ollie Gordon II of Oklahoma State, Devin Neal of Kansas, and D.H. Giddens of Kansas State, and Ja'Cory Krosky-Merritt of Arizona were all drafted. That's quite a haul from one conference. ASU fans know well the impact a running back can have because of what Scadabo meant in the Sun Devils' run last season. ASU will likely go with a running back by committee because of the depth there, with Kyson Brown leading the way. And that was the article, ASU's Chance at Repeating Among the Storylines. Well, we're coming up on 37 minutes past the hour. I think we have time for another article or two, depending on their length. Let's turn the front page of the sports section over and see what's available inside the sports section. Whoa, this is weird. Article is entitled "Boxer Found Dead in Hotel Room After Fight in Phoenix." Written by Jeremy Clough for the Arizona Republic. The article goes like this. The boxing community is mourning Pedro Antonio Rodriguez, known as Tony, after the boxer was found dead in his Phoenix hotel room after a fight on July 5th. Rodriguez, who is 37, from Mexico, fought Philip Vela, V-E-L-L-A, who is 21, at the American Royal Palace in Phoenix during a Del Sol boxing promotion fight on July 5th, but was found dead in his hotel room hours later. Vela beat Rodriguez by unanimous decision in a 6-round bout that was sanctioned by the Arizona State Boxing and the MMA Commission. Rodriguez's wife, Carla Valenzuela, said in a statement, quote, "He called me when his fight ended. Even when the show was over and he left for the hotel, he talked to me. He made a video call. He told me that he was going out to buy dinner and that he was coming back because at 3:30 a.m. in the morning, they were going to pick them up to take them to the airport. That was the only thing I talked to him about. I don't really know what happened, some kind of blow. I'm also confused. We have to wait until tomorrow to see what the report says." Unquote. Police are investigating the cause of Rodriguez's death. He had a 15-26-3 record during a career that started back in 2007. He made a comeback to the ring this year, with this being his second bout after a 6-year break. Del Sol Boxing issued the following statement on social media. Quote, "The Del Sol Boxing family is heartbroken at the death of Pedro Antonio Rodriguez. Our hearts and thoughts are with his loved ones. Out of respect for his family, please join us in waiting for the local authorities to complete their work and investigation." Unquote. Rodriguez was found unresponsive in his hotel room on July 6th after not showing up for his ride to the airport. Vela also reacted on social media and said, quote, "Truly heartbroken to find out this news. Thankful to have shared the ring with Pedro for 6 rounds. My thought and prayers are with his family. Rest easy, champion." Unquote. And that was the article, "Boxer Found Dead in Hotel Room After Fight in Phoenix." And here's an article about soccer from Phoenix. The Rising hit road for 3 games on hunt for playoff pace. Written by Roman Aguilar for the Arizona Republic. At the midway mark of a marathon USL championship season, Phoenix Rising Football Club finds itself in the thick of a tightly packed Western Conference playoff race. A 5-5-5 record and 20 points have the club sixth in the standings. But if you ask head coach Pa Madu Ka, there's still more to unlock from a team that has shown flashes of brilliance but left crucial points on the table. During a media availability on Wednesday, June 9th, Ka said, quote, "We are a good team in this league, but I think we can become a greater team. If we take better care of our opportunities and the chances that we create, then I think we play very well," unquote. The club has scored more goals than it had at this point last season, yet it still struggles to convert that attacking potential into points regularly. Phoenix has scored at least 2 goals in more than half of its league matches, 8 out of 15, posting a 4-1-3 record in those contests. Coach Ka said, quote, "We score goals, it's not like we don't, but how do you take those opportunities and retain? That's the balance. Sometimes that's part of football," unquote. Rising's latest setback, a 1-0 home loss to Lexington SC on July 4th, highlighted the team's ongoing search for the killer mentality that Ka has emphasized. Still, he's not panicking heading into a challenging stretch of road matches. He said, quote, "There's good progress that has happened. We can control our work ethic, who we are as human beings, our characters, our culture, and I think we've done all of those things. Now, can we transfer that into more points on a weekly basis?" Unquote. Well, the July 12th match at the Oakland Roots presents a chance to start that transformation. The Roots record is 4-6-5 with 17 points. They've found form of late. They posted 3 straight wins while shutting out opponents across 360 consecutive minutes in regular season action. Oakland has not conceded a goal since mid-June and sits just 3 points behind Phoenix in the USL Championship Western Conference. So the last time that Phoenix visited the East Bay, the club did not play at the Coliseum. Saturday marks the Rising's first ever match there, but the team does hold a 4-2-3 all-time record against Oakland, which includes a 1-0 win back in March of 2024. Rising forward Jurel Margaritha, who returned from international duty with Curacao last week, is expected to help lead the attack once again. He has scored 4 goals across all competitions this year, and says building momentum during this July road stretch is key. He said, quote, "Every point is important, but especially now. For our own feelings in the group, it's good to win some games, get some points. When you lose, everybody's feeling a bit down. So if we start winning, everybody will feel good again. The spirit is there," unquote. Margaritha, who recently completed his first Gold Cup with Curacao, said he's trying to bring that experience back to Phoenix as part of the club's leadership group. He said, quote, "You get experience at another level. You can help the guys here," unquote. Well, after Oakland, Phoenix heads to El Paso and then to Orange County, completing its final 3-match road trip of the season. Now, the club has fared well away from home. They've gone 3-2-3 on the road, and they've outscored their opponents 19-16. The July 12th kickoff is scheduled for 7 p.m. at the Oakland Coliseum. The match will be broadcast on ESPN Plus, Arizona Family Sports, Rising Radio in English, and La Onda 99.5 FM in Spanish. And that's the article, Rising Hit Road for 3 Games on Hunt for Playoff Pace. At 44 minutes past the hour, it's time for us to read an opinion piece. Laurie Roberts' opinion piece is entitled, Representative Hamadeh Pulls a Cruel Trick on His Constituents. Here's what she wrote. Arizona U.S. Representative Abe Hamadeh is touting his proud vote for President Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill with a big, ugly magic trick. The bill, Hamadeh assures us, quote, includes no cuts to Medicaid, unquote. Oh, right. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, will reduce Medicaid spending by $1 trillion over the next decade, yet not a single American who qualifies for coverage will be cut off? Well, it's a miracle. Either that, or it's a cruel trick, a startling sleight-of-hand illusion designed to convince you that the richest people in America can get a $1 trillion tax cut and nobody will pay for it. But when the lights come up, just coincidentally after the 2026 midterm elections, millions of low-income Americans will find themselves without health insurance, including, presumably, a few of the 166,990 of Hamadeh's constituents that are now covered by the Arizona Health Care Cost Containment System, because that's the state's Medicaid program. And the rest of us will be picking up the tab when the newly uninsured inevitably go to the emergency room for care and can't pay the bill. But no cuts to Medicaid, says the Ricky Jay of the Northwest Valley. Now, technically speaking, Hamadeh is right. The bill does not explicitly kick poor people off Medicaid by changing who is eligible for the program. Instead, it wraps them up in so much red tape and paperwork that people who otherwise would qualify won't be able to get or stay enrolled in the program. Date changes, deadline changes, changes to document requirements and rules, all of them designed to trip people up and push them out. Republicans insist that only cheaters will be impacted, the fraudsters and the illegal immigrants that they insist, without evidence, are on the program. But virtually everybody else says we can expect broad enrollment cuts. An estimated 11.8 Americans could lose their coverage over the next decade, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. In Arizona, 360,000 people are likely to lose their coverage, according to an analysis by KFF. That's an independent health policy and news organization. But, quote, no cuts to Medicaid, unquote, according to Arizona's own David Copperfield, who is proud to have voted for the largest Medicaid cuts in history. And this to pay for tax cuts that range from modest to massive. Hamadeh says the bill, quote, delivers the largest tax cut for middle and working class Americans in history and secures increases in paychecks and take-home pay for the hardworking families in Arizona's 8th Congressional District, unquote. Well, it also delivers an average annual tax cut of $103,500 a year to the top 0.1% of earners, those people making $3.3 million or more a year. That's according to the Yale Budget Lab. Overall, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act will reduce taxes for the top 1% of earners by more than $1 trillion over the next decade. But when the magic show is over and the lights come up, there is a price to be paid for that. 11 million people, that is, who will likely lose their access to Medicaid to save, wait for it, $1 trillion. Hamadeh should at least be honest about that. Now you see it, soon you won't. And that was Loy Roberts' opinion piece. Representative Hamadeh pulls a cruel trick on his constituents. At 48 minutes past the hour, we're moving on over to the entertainment section. We're going to begin by reading today's horoscopes. Okay, we're going to begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Are you staying composed under stress? A professional crisis highlights your leadership credentials. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, are you seeing the whole picture? Click the last puzzle piece into place. A vision of your future coalesces under the Capricorn full moon. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st. Are you doing the responsible thing? Settling a debt with a loved one sets things straight. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd. Are you pooling your resources? Achieving your mission requires you to join forces with another under the Capricorn full moon. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, do you need to make some improvements? Don't just speculate. Set the plan in motion. For you fellow Virgos out there with birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, are you seeing the fruits of your labor? The slow and steady approach wins you the race. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, are you addressing what you have overlooked? A personal matter demands your attention. Do not put it off. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, are you facing the facts? You discover something important. Work with this new information. Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, are you reclaiming what is yours? Under the Capricorn full moon, it's time to say, enough is enough. Draw a boundary. Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates, are you putting your foot down? Well, today's full moon falls in your sign. Acknowledge how you have self-abandoned these past 2 weeks. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates, are you having a morning epiphany? Under the Capricorn full moon, stillness is the move. Let a mystical transmission guide you. And finally, Pisces, birthdays from February 19th to March 20th. Where have you been? Prepare to field this question from friends during Capricorn's full moon. And that was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, I've been seeing my partner, Gil, for 5 years. After my husband passed, Gil came into my life again. We had been colleagues about 10 years prior. We always had a spark, but never acted on it, as I was deeply committed to my late husband. After the funeral, Gil came into my life with guns blazing. We struck up a friendship, and it wasn't long before it became more. I've come to care deeply for him, and I want to be there for him as he is older and facing some health issues. My problem is Gil and his youngest daughter, Nicole, are very close. I initially wanted a warm relationship with her and went out of my way to orchestrate vacations and time together. Well, fast forward to now. I dislike Nicole immensely because she takes advantage of her dad. She's rude, inconsiderate, and holier than everyone, even though she would have nothing if not for her father's generosity. I hesitate to call her out because then I'll become the bad guy, which she has already tried to make me out to be. Nicole is in her late 20s with kids of her own. I'm younger than Gil, and I know she sees me as a threat. I know there is some jealousy there, but I'm concerned for his well-being. His health isn't great, and Nicole is never around for doctor's appointments, etc. I want to be gracious because she can do no wrong in his eyes. Your input would be greatly appreciated. Signed, Caring About Him. And Abby responds, Dear Caring, continue to be gracious to Nicole. As I see it, you have little choice. Because she can do no wrong in her daddy's eyes, even if you try to point out otherwise, it won't endear you to either of them. What you must decide is which is more important to you, calling out Nicole's glaring flaws or the relationship with her father. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, as a young mother, I endured a difficult marriage filled with domestic abuse. In the midst of that turmoil, I struggled to be the parent my children needed. They are adults now, and I find myself distanced from them. It pains me deeply to know they want nothing to do with me. I can't help but feel I ruined their lives, and the weight of that thought is unbearable. I miss them dearly and long for the chance to reconnect and heal our relationship. I'm at the crossroads and unsure of how to move forward and mend the bonds that have been strained. I deeply regret my past mistakes and want to make things right, but I'm uncertain where to start. Thank you for your guidance. Signed, Lost and Overwhelmed in Canada. Dear Lost, I know of no perfect parents. Everyone makes mistakes. I wish you had mentioned why you think you ruined your children's lives. Were you physically or emotionally abusive? Did you abandon them? If that's what happened, reach out. apologize, and offer to join them in family counseling if they are willing. It might be a healthy first step towards reconciliation. And remember, you can contact Abigail Van Buren two different ways. You can go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can write her a letter and mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069 is the zip code. And now let's wish some happy birthday thoughts to some celebrities. All right, who is turning a year older today? The actor William Smithers turns 98 today. I don't remember what he has ever acted in. Singer Mavis Staples turns 86. Actress Fiona Shaw turns 67. Actress Sofia Vergara turns 53 today. And actor Chiwetel Ejiofor turns 48. And the singer Jessica Simpson turns 45 today. Congratulations and happy birthday to all of them. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, July 10th, 2025. I hope you have a great day today, and I hope you keep on listening. Bye for now.